Well, I'm Brian Gelder. I'd like to present to you our presentation on the environmental impacts of continental scale biofuel production. And I'd like to first recognize my co-authors, Robert Annex, Chris Anderson, Ray Arrett, Dale Hurlsman, Phil Gassman, Sami Kanal, and Manoj Jha. Without them, it's definitely a multidisciplinary project. Without them, I wouldn't be here presenting this data. First, I'd like to get started with a quick introduction of the hydrologic cycle. We've got over here, we've got the sun driving pretty much the whole system. We've got sun creating evaporation, transpiration through the vegetation, water surfaces, the soil, driving cloud formation. Cloud formations under certain conditions turn into rain clouds, precipitation, runoff, some infiltration, and we start the whole system again with evaporation. Now this graphic illustrates the fact that climate and land cover, they're inextricably linked. You can't separate the two, but if humans have previously sought to alter this feedback system and try to alter the climate. Around the turn of the 20th century, they created the 30,000-acre Nebraska National Forest in the central Sandhill region of Nebraska, with the goal of ameliorating the environment. After long consideration, they realized it really isn't possible to ameliorate the environment to the extent that they were hoping, and it's really exposed that there's only certain limits that we can modify the climate. And I'll show a couple studies that have shown this before. They're having real problems in the sandhills. The pine trees aren't reproducing. It's still too dry, even though they've started essentially a large forest there that's not actually going to be able to reproduce itself. There's been some other studies more recently looking at actual land changes that have occurred through the last century, and they have shown that we have modified the climate in certain areas. One of these is Christie et al. They've linked the higher nighttime temperatures to the expanse of irrigation in the Central Valley of California. We've got higher nighttime temperatures. Well, the higher night temperatures are due to the increased humidity in the air, which is actually retaining heat in the atmosphere. Again, we've got similar currents in the Midwest. We've got higher summertime humidity levels, and that's also increasing moderating some of the temperatures in the Midwest. And that's as we've increased the row crop production in the central Midwest to move from less small grains and grasslands in the Midwest. So these changes have gotten us to thinking. We've got some potential large-scale land use changes coming in the near future. The renewable fuel standard, which we've been talking about throughout today's seminar presentations, it's estimating there's going to be demanding that there's going to be 22 billion gallons of advanced biofuels produced in the United States by 2022. A lot of this is projected to come from cellulosic crops, and it's estimating this could take up to 100 million acres to produce the amount of biofuels that we need, and 100 million acres is a substantial area. State of Iowa is approximately about 35 million acres. It's about an area about three times the size of the state of Iowa, if you wanted for a comparison. These advanced biofuels are going to have a different evapotranspiration profile than the crops that we are currently growing in these areas, in most areas. And the predominant ones that are looked at are switchgrass, miscanthus, and hybrid poplar. These all have when compared to the typical crops that are currently grown in the areas, they've got an earlier emergence, a longer growing season, and resulting in similar or greater total evapotranspiration. And they're actually more similar to the original vegetation that was in the area, usually, than what we are currently growing in these areas. And so our question is, are these changes going to result in changes to the climate and or environmental quality? Kind of a brief outline or overview of what we're attempting to do with this project. We've got a meteorological model essentially these are the boundaries for our meteorological model. Pretty much the continental United States, the lower 48, and parts of Canada and Mexico. We have that linked with a land cover model, and we have dynamic linking going back and forth, sharing these components that are parameters from the model back and forth, or function model. And then we're also trying to drive, we're using the output, the radiation, precipitation, temperature, and wind output to drive two models to help us look at fine scale erosion, water stress impacts, and then also a larger scale sediment water yield, phosphorus and nitrate yield impacts of the biofuel production. Again, a little more detail on our meteorological model. It's we're using a WRF or the MM5 similar meteorological model. We've done a climate baseline scenario simulation using the 1979 to 2004 North American regional reanalysis data. So it's a kind of a control simulation. And then we're applying a land cover change to this NOAA land cover model in our second set of model runs. And then we run the meteorological model again using the same boundary conditions, so the same boundary conditions on the eastern and western, northern and southern sides, and we actually let the model do its thing within the domain of the model. And we've implemented this this modeling program at a 25-kilometer resolution. To estimate where we saw land cover changes, we used the PolySys economic model, and it was used at a county representation. And so it allocates switchgrass. There's a planned payment level for the switchgrass, and at that level we determined where it would displace pasture, hay, and crop acreage in some suitable counties across the country, and to provide a maximum economic return to farmers. And these county level estimates were then resampled to the 25-kilometer grid spacing that we used to run the meteorological model. Here's a representation of the projected fraction of the county in switchgrass in 2022. You can see we do have a border. I think the last tier of counties in western tier of counties in Kansas is essentially where it becomes too dry to project to grow switchgrass. Similar thing up in Oklahoma and Kansas or Oklahoma and Texas here. And so we're projecting somewhere in Oklahoma and Kansas to actually see up to about 30 to 50% of the county being converted to switchgrass production in this model scenario, and we see some 10 to 20% levels in other portions of the country as well. We do have some limitations in our land cover model. It's only able to simulate one land cover at each cell location. So essentially, we're picking the majority or greatest land cover fraction in each one of those cell locations, and so that results in some granularity in our modeling simulation. So in central Oklahoma, we're projecting most of our switchgrass production where we're actually simulating a switchgrass grassland or switchgrass cropland mix of crops. Since we actually didn't get over 50% switchgrass production in any of these areas, we actually had to modify the parameters a little bit so we could actually, the model would actually give us something different than what it was simulating in the control scenario, because when you don't actually change the land cover, the model, when you don't get over that maximum or majority land cover classification, there's no change. The model doesn't see any change. That's a limitation of the model that we're currently working with that we'd like to remedy in the future. And again, we have some more grassland switchgrass, cropland switchgrass in the surrounding areas here as well. So we went with this representation to actually, so the model would actually produce some different results for us. Here we've got some parameters for the new vegetation types. Essentially, we changed the maximum albedo a little bit, the leaf area minimum and maximum. Over here on the right, we have, for reference, we have the dryland, cropland, pasture type. This is type 2 in the model, and the grassland type 7 in the model. And to represent switchgrass, since there aren't any large areas of switchgrass currently grown, we kind of blended the characteristics of the dryland, cropland, and the grassland to get a representation of the surface roughness and maximum LAI and minimum LAI of a switchgrass grassland or switchgrass cropland or grassland switchgrass grassland cropland switchgrass mixtures. Then we are using these models, or using the model climate model output to drive the Iowa Daily Erosion Project, which simulates some changes in water stress, erosion, and runoff for the Iowa between the baseline and alternative scenario, and then simulating changes in the sediment, water yield, and phosphorus and nitrate loading between the baseline and alternative scenarios using a SWOT model of the Upper Mississippi River Basin. Although we won't have much results to show for this because our polyacist model projections actually showed very little switchgrass production in these areas, so we actually don't have much for direct impacts. We're hoping to see some climate impacts in these areas over the longer term, but we don't have direct impacts from the land cover changes in these areas, just because polyacist is not projecting we're going to grow much switchgrass in these areas. So this map, some of our preliminary results. This shows the difference in the average annual temperature between the biofuel and the control scenarios. Here in blue, we have temperature decreases. In white, we have essentially no temperature change, a temperature change of negative 0.1 to 0.1 degrees Celsius. And then in the red, we have a little bit of increase. And in the red, it's a couple actual urban locations and one boundary location. We've had a little bit of change. So we don't think those are real representative results. When they're small, one or two cell pixel representations, we don't have much confidence in those. But in the area where we're projecting to grow the biofuels, as you can see down here, we're projecting temperature decreases of up to almost a half a degree Celsius over the average annual time frame. And then that decreases as we decrease the amount of switchgrass that we're growing. And we think this is due to some of the changes in the evapotranspiration. We've got more evapotranspiration occurring earlier in the growing season in these areas. And that evapotranspiration cools down the atmosphere as it occurs. These are some breakout slides showing May, June, July, August, September, October, June, July, August, and May, June, July, August, September, October averages, or multi-month averages, all showing similar things. We've got again, we've still got the cooling area here in Kansas and Oklahoma, and in certain monthly time periods, we show a little bit more of a temperature increase in some of the surrounding areas. And here we have a month-by-month breakout. In October, in December, we've actually got a problem with some of our data was not implemented into the model, and it's corrupted our average, but the rest of the months are representative of all the data. And again, certain times of the year, we see more of a increase in temperature in the surrounding areas, but again, we still see mostly a cooling trend in that area where we're projecting the switchgrass growing. And you also see in some of the areas like Tennessee, where there's a little bit of switchgrass being grown, we see similar cooling trends as well. Now this graph, this figure shows the difference in the average annual rainfall between the biofuel and the control scenarios. So in the greenish-blue areas here, we are showing increases in average annual rainfall. So we've got more evapotranspiration, and it's actually resulting in some more local rainfall. And in the margins, you know, in the surrounding area, we're actually showing a decrease in precipitation. And we break that out into the monthly grouping time frame groupings again, and we still see again especially in this August, September, October time frame, we see this increase in precipitation over the crop or the switchgrass area. And again, here's a month by month breakout again. Again, you want to ignore the December results, but in April, we're showing some precipitation trends here in Texas, and in May, we're showing some trends on the margin here again in Arkansas, Louisiana. And then in August, we show our increase in precipitation on the areas of the switchgrass production. Now, getting a little bit into the environmental impacts, we've had some challenges running the models. We haven't progressed as far on the environmental impacts as we'd like. But we have done some calculations on the rainfall erosivity factor, one of the simplest measures of trying to estimate environmental impacts. And for the large-scale coarse resolution data sets that we have, that's one of the easiest ways to try and elucidate some of these environmental impacts. And we show an increase in this area of 5 to 10% increase in rainfall erosivity where we're projecting to grow the switchgrass, and that's because we're seeing that increase in August, in mostly late summer precipitation in this area, and we're showing a little bit of a decrease in rainfall erosivity again on the margins. And that's the current state of our modeling project, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them if we have time.
Yes.
Sure,
yes.
What we do.
Questions or agenda? Yes.
First of all, I thought it was funny that you cut off your simulation right in Colorado.
Well, we there's one tier of counties in Kansas that loses out as well. So.
On these erosivity factors, a lot of the climate change projections are very different than this, and that they're finding a higher intensity rain, even if you have lower rainfall. So, does your model have the capability of calculating the R factor based on intensity or just total erosivity?
Our model can simulate rainfall intensity down to about the 1 hour time frame. So we're extrapolating from that back down to a 30-minute time frame, which is used in the erosivity index, the R factor calculations. So we're using both the total intensity and total amounts to calculate our rainfall erosivity, but we don't have a whole lot of confidence in our intensity calculations because the model isn't really designed to go much below 3 hour intensity, but we're pushing the model to its limits to try and get a rainfall erosivity estimate out of it. And none of these scenarios include any climate change component, so it's kind of interesting. It shows some of the reverse effects that we've seen in the climate scenarios, and that could indicate that some of our current land management changes that we've caused to occur over the last 50 years, where we produced more annual crops and less perennial grasses and some of the small grains in some of these areas, are confounding some of the signals we're seeing in increased precipitation intensity and temperature over the last 20 years. You know, we've shown in the upper Midwest we're getting more intense storms and a little decrease in daily temperature variation. The nighttime temperature is a little higher, and that, you know, part of that is some of this more row crops we're producing. We're pushing more water into the atmosphere in the summertime.
Thank you.
Thank you.